This is the short edition of More or Less, first broadcast on the BBC World Service.
Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to More or Less on the BBC World Service. We're your weekly guide to the numbers in the news and in life, and I'm Tim Harford. First, a few weeks ago, the world of psychology was shaken by the findings of something called the Reproducibility Project. The project, led by the psychologist Brian Nozick of the Centre for Open Science, coordinated 270 researchers in an effort to go back and check almost 100 studies that had been published in three leading psychology journals. The Reproducibility Project team found that only 39 of these replication attempts were able to confirm the original findings, in the opinion of the team. 36% found statistically significant results, and the effect sizes in the replications were half as big as those in the originals. So overall, the Reproducibility Project would seem to suggest that if you read about a study in a highly regarded psychology journal, the chances are that that study will not be repeatable. So what should we make of all this? We talked to several researchers, starting with Gavin Sullivan of Coventry University in the UK. He was one of a small army of researchers who worked on replicating single studies.
One of the first tasks was really determining the number of participants needed to have sufficient power to test the result, to have a robust result. A second task was to gain all the original materials that were used from the first study and check with the authors of the first study that we were replicating it correctly.
As it happens, Gavin Sullivan did manage to reproduce the study he was checking, but he was in a minority there.
Yes, it is a concern that only 36% of the replications found significant results. That is quite worrying when you consider that the three journals that the 100 studies were taken from are all very highly regarded journals.
Dr. Gavin Sullivan. Now, you might be wondering how so many studies can be non-reproducible despite having passed the usual statistical tests. Well, one problem is that when researchers conduct a study, they have a vast choice of ways in which they could analyse the data. So many variables to collect, so many interactions to look at. Does the finding stand up only for men? Only for women? Only for low or high socioeconomic groups? Does it perhaps vary by weight or height or the menstrual cycle? In case you think I'm being gratuitous here, there's a famous psychological study suggesting that a woman's monthly fertility influences her voting. Given the number of variables, there are many possible patterns and many ways to stumble upon what looks like a statistically significant result, but will just be the result of chance. Then there's the problem of publication bias. Boring results, predictable results, results that aren't statistically significant will all tend to end up at the bottom of desk drawers. Surprising, exciting new results will tend to be published. But of course, they may be surprising, exciting, and new because they're wrong. Andrew Gelman, a statistician at Columbia University, was part of the team that put together the Reproducibility Project. He thinks the way psychologists publish their research is a big problem.
I think they should publish less and they should publish more at the same time. When I say I think they should publish less, I think they should make weaker, more realistic claims.
So Andrew Gelman means that psychologists shouldn't be trying to claim astonishing new insights into human nature every single time they publish a research paper. And by publish more, he means that all the data from all the disappointing experiments should be publicly available on some repository. It may not have produced an exciting or statistically significant result, but data are data, and they're all grist to the scientific mill. So was Andrew Gelman surprised that so few psychological findings were reproducible?
The results were not a surprise to me. If you look at the published claims and you realize that they're not that plausible, it's not so surprising that they won't reproduce. If you look into the statistical theory a little bit, you'll realize that the probability of a result reproducing is quite low. It's not 95% or anything like that.
Statistician Andrew Gelman. So is the Reproducibility Project an embarrassment for psychology, or is it an inspiring collaboration in the true spirit of scientific inquiry? Here's Daryl O'Connor, the chair of the British Psychological Society's Research Board.
Of course, it was disappointing when one initially looked at the results. However, to my mind, there's a number of factors that may account for that. So just because a study wasn't replicated doesn't necessarily mean that it was false in the first instance. But I think it represents an opportunity and a challenge for us to really improve our reporting methods, improve how we go about science. But I don't think we can suggest this is, again, a psychological problem. We have, I think, a cultural and scientifical cultural issue which we need to shift.
Professor Daryl O'Connor of the University of Leeds. Andrew Gelman agrees that it's not just psychology that's at fault, but he argues that psychology is especially vulnerable to these problems.
I think parts of psychology are in particularly bad shape. I'm not an expert, but I've heard that a lot of medical research is in bad shape for similar reasons. Psychology, in a way, is the worst of all worlds in that they have a lot of noise. There's a lot of pressure to get statistical significance. There's a lot of ways that people can exclude data improperly. But it's also a very open field, so you can actually see what people are doing. Medicine, a lot of things are hidden. There's a lot of rules why they say there's confidentiality. Everything's a big secret. So psychologists are, it's good for them. I'd almost say they're too open for their own good, but ultimately it is for their own good to learn that there are these problems. So maybe they're ahead of the curve because of their openness.
Professor Andrew Gelman of Columbia University. You're listening to More or Less. If you were listening last week, you may remember this, the Marvelettes, rather rashly claiming back in 1964 that there were too many fish in the sea. And as part of the following piece on the decline of marine life, I was heard to say this. So I can see that that's not a bad summary indicator of biodiversity. Maybe not a great indicator of biomass, though, because you might have very big populations that haven't shrunk much and small populations that have been decimated. Well, I thought there might be trouble, so I then said, and if you'd like to send us an email about anything, including my use of the word decimated in that interview, our email address is moreorless@bbc.co. Oh dear.
I would like to make a comment regarding the word decimated, which, as I tag this...
I reckon the proper use of decimate is gone forever. Another case of switching to the US...
Was one out of ten executed, as in the Roman legion?
Especially by BBC reporters, to mean 90% reduction.
Doesn't someone check your material before you go on air?
Indeed, doesn't someone check my material before I go on air? Well, yes, I do, as it happens. I was aware of the Roman practice of decimation, punishing rebellious soldiers by drawing lots and executing one man in ten. And so, before last week's programme was broadcast, I consulted both the Oxford English Dictionary and the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Both said that decimate can be used as a synonym for devastate. And indeed, that is the usual modern usage. But following this week's emails, I thought I'd triple check. So I rang Oliver Cam, author of Accidents Will Happen, The Non-Pedantic Guide to English Usage. Oliver, was I wrong?
No, you're quite right. The meaning of decimate in the sense of destroy a large part of is overwhelmingly the dominant sense in which the word is used, and it's attested for centuries. The historical sense of destroy one in every 10 member of a Roman legion is a historical curiosity. It's been used in the sense that you used it, Tim, for well over 300 years, so you're absolutely entitled to do it. It's only pedants who insist on this etymological route who will criticise you, and you will note that none of them refer to December as the 10th month of the year, even though it comes from the same etymological root.
Oliver Cam. And that's all we have time for this week. Please keep your comments coming in to moreorless@bbc.co.uk, whether they're about my grammar or even the statistical stories that catch your interest. Our website is bbc.com/moreorless. Until next week, goodbye.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.